I know something you don't know. You don't know what you don't know. None of us do. How could we? Especially when our not knowing is strategically combined with the intentions of people in power, like politicians and designers of educational systems and writers of curriculum, who've exhibited zero qualms about filling in our not knowing with what reflects and serves their values and their purposes to promote and perpetuate the mindset of white superiority. I am so grateful to Jennifer Hawthorne for sharing with us about her own school experiences in Louisiana in the 50s and 60s. Hello, and thank you for being here. My name is Nene White, and this is my podcast, One White Woman with a Lot of Questions. Hey, Jennifer Hawthorne, thank you for joining me in conversation.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me, Nene.
We are Facebook friends, and you wrote about an amazing or disturbing or enlightening, I'm not sure which, kind of experience about your junior high school days and what's happening with your high school now. And I would love to hear about that and have everyone else hear about it.
Oh, sure. You know, I was just so shocked the other morning. I was watching morning news, and all of a sudden there was a video clip of a man named Reverend Chambers standing up at the East Baton Rouge Parish school board meeting in my hometown of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, really confronting others about racial issues that were going on there. And in particular, the point that was being discussed, which was to change the name of my high school, which was Robert E. Lee High. And I was very intrigued by this. And it really made me begin to reflect so much on my background and where I came from growing up in the Deep South in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and where I am today.
As a white woman, as a white
person. Yes, yes, that's right. Yes. Would you like me to talk a little bit more about the things that I talked about in the post, Nene?
I just thought that was so fascinating, but whatever you're inspired to do, maybe you've had some other revelations, whatever feels right to you.
Okay. Well, you know, Lehigh was really something. When I was in high school, I entered when I was in junior high, actually. It was the first year that the school had opened. And so I went into seventh grade, and I was the first class that went through 6 years of middle school and then high school, and graduated in 1965. And one of the things that I was really reflecting on in my post, particularly not only just because of that meeting, but because of all the protests, the Black Lives Matter movement, everything that's going on right now, I was just so remembering how we revered Robert E. Lee, you know, the general, the Confederate general. We revered the Confederate flag. We were the Lehigh Rebels. I was in a group of girls who marched at halftime with the band. We were called the Confederettes, and we wore red and white and gray, which were the colors of the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. And we were ingrained with that culture. And, you know, our favorite motto was, "The South shall rise again." And we just had no idea. That was the realization that I began to have, that we had no idea what all of those things really stood for.
Of course.
You know? And then in 1963, it would have been, that was when our high school was integrated for the first time. And I'll never forget the first morning of school, because the white police had to accompany five African-American students who were just terrified to our, you know, all-white school. And it was just such an event. And, you know, today I just look back at all of that, and I'm so grateful for everything that's going on, because I see how incredibly hurtful these things were and are, and how it has to be a time for change now.
Long overdue.
Yeah.
What was it like that first day? And then I have some other questions too, but what was it like when they were ushered in, and what was it like to have them in your classes and in the lunchroom?
Yes. Well, you know, at first I think that everybody was scared of everybody. The white students were scared of the Black students, and the Black students were scared of the white students. But honestly, over time, you know, some of us started to really break the ice. First of all, because these students were such wonderful people. I mean, that's what I remember about them. You know, one of them in particular, I wish I could remember her name. She was funny. She was personable. She was outgoing. And, you know, I feel that I had some part in breaking the ice between the two races, simply because my parents had raised me in such a way that I really was not afraid to sit at the lunch table with them.
Yeah.
And so I started doing that. And then other students started joining me. You know, at first, a lot of my white friends just didn't get it. But I felt that it was so important. And I don't think I had anything that was so conscious going on at that time. But it was just some kind of, I don't even say it was a kindness. It was just something that I think my mother probably had ingrained in me, you know, that people are people, and why should we separate ourselves from a group of students because they have a different color of skin? My mother was British, so she didn't grow up in the Deep South, and she had a very different sensibility about these things. And my father was very, very liberal. And so I feel that I had some balance, you know, to all the cultural conditioning that was going on.
And so when your friends saw you sitting there, then how did they treat you at first? And then how did they treat you later? And then what was the response of the African-American kids who were sitting there all in their small bunch?
Well, I think that the students themselves were very surprised. But, you know, over time, it became very natural. And at first, the white students, you know, my white friends, they didn't understand why I would be doing something like that. Because you have to remember, you know, I was growing up, as were my friends, obviously the same age as I was, at a time when, you know, restaurants had been segregated. The buses were segregated. You know, there were the separate restrooms for Blacks and whites. And so it was a huge shift for us, just massive. But like all things, over time, it just began to be more acceptable. And because I was a leader in my school, I think that that helped to break that ice and make the whole integration, the social integration, much more acceptable.
Oh my gosh, I wish we weren't so far away. I give you a great big hug.
thank you, Nini.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you know, this just sounds like such good sense, you know, and then it's just so interesting to contrast it with the programming that the school officials tried to put into all of you kids.
I know. It's remarkable, really.
Oh, it's really. That's the thing to be afraid of. Tell me, how many kids just stayed programmed and how many kids came over to the sides of, you know, just wait a minute, we're all just human beings. What was the ratio?
You know, I really have no idea, Nini, and I couldn't answer that. However, I will say that while I'm not friends with many people that I grew up with on Facebook, I'm friends with a couple, and both of them had extremely positive responses to my Facebook post about this. And I was surprised, honestly. One of them, I wasn't surprised. You know, he left the South even to go to college, and I think he graduated from Yale. The other one is still in Baton Rouge. You know, I see her at every high school reunion. And I had no idea how she would respond if she saw that. And she just posted, "That's my girl." And I was really, really pleased with that, because, you know, I did not have the same response from one of my sisters who still lives in the area. She lives right outside of Baton Rouge. I have two younger sisters, both of whom graduated from Lee. And the youngest sister, who lives in Fairfield, Iowa now, she had a very, very positive response. She shared my post and she wrote her own story about, you know, growing up during those times. But our middle sister, who still lives in the Baton Rouge area, she's not even on Facebook, but I sent her our other sisters and mine's and my post. And she was so angry about it. And, you know, she just felt that things like the Confederate flag and statues of Confederate generals are, they're part of history. They are part of history. So I thought about that, and I have thought about this a lot in the past, you know, just in recent years, when the whole issue of the Confederate flag and the whole issue of statues has been coming up. You know, I've really reflected on it. And at first, that was my attitude also. These are such an important part of history. Then I started to ask myself, well, do we want to honor anyone and everyone who has had a significant role in history? Mm-hmm. Because if that were true, then there would be statues of Hitler in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I researched this, and there are no statues of Hitler in Germany. Mm-hmm. And there are very few of Stalin and Lenin in Russia, by the way. And I feel that makes sense to me. That makes absolute sense to me. Would we even want that in a museum? It feels to me like a statue is an honoring gesture. You know, it's an honoring expression. Maybe in a museum, it could work. But I really have a new understanding of why people feel the way they do about these. And yet here's my sister who just can hardly have a conversation about it. She can't. She actually would not, she would not respond to my suggestion that maybe it was okay that there weren't any statues of Hitler remaining in Germany.
Yeah. Okay.
It's deep. It is really deep.
It is deep. It is deep. And it's so interesting. You had the same parents.
Yes.
You had the same messages on both sides from your school people and from your family. And
I know it's really remarkable. Yeah. It's really remarkable.
I mean, my brother voted a completely different way than I did, you know, and there are no conversations. And, you know, it's so interesting because if we could just have a conversation, even if I don't want you to, you know, for the one purpose of making you think the way I think and I think, or I think the way you think, if we could just listen to each other, let's just, can we just do that? Can we just do that? Just out of, you know, a sense of, well, you have some brains. I've known you my whole life. You know, can we just have a conversation? I mean, to not even take it to where it might go, to just have that conversation. That's what I'm hoping to see in this country. Have you heard of Braver Angels?
No, I don't think so. What is that?
Wow. I'll put the link up. This is what they do. They have conversations between red and blue factions, basically, for the purpose of conversation.
Wow.
And the mutual respect that gets developed in those brief encounters that are beautifully structured and mutual respect. It's very, very impressive, but I don't want to take away from your experience. I wanted to ask you at least one more question about was there any pushback from the faculty in the lunchroom when you did that?
Oh, no, not at all. Not that I recall anyway. I think that they were, you know, really, really wonderful people. I mean, the thing that's one of the things that's so interesting to me, Nini, is that I feel like I got a fantastic education. You know, Louisiana schools are not in the top of the country, but I feel as though my sisters and I both got a really remarkable education. We had wonderful teachers there, and regardless of the fact that we, you know, all thought that the South might rise again, you know, I think that the teachers really they were very accepting. I think they felt that it was their role as teachers to really accommodate, if not outright support, everything that mm-hmm. was happening. Mm-hmm. And I feel that they did a really wonderful job of helping those students really ultimately be welcomed into our school culture.
Oh, I am so glad I asked you that question, because I almost didn't. And that is so heartening. We need to hear things like this. And we would assume it about teachers, because what are they about, you know?
I know. You would hope that that would happen.
Yes.
And I would say that in the case of Robert E. Lee High, it definitely did.
Oh, that is, oh, good. Thank you.
Because
sometimes
welcome.
In these conversations, your heart is just, you know, under 500 tons of weight of, you know, but you have to keep digging and thinking and feeling so that we can grow into the reality of what Blacks in America have been living with all this time.
I know. And it's so true.
And we need to do that. It's the only way that we're all going to be together eventually. And you know, one thing that you said about the South rising again, you know, it could, just not quite in the way they're thinking. You know?
Right.
Good point. Yeah, this is what we want. Oh.
Yeah. But you know, Nini, one other thing that I would really like to include in this time that we have together is something that I put in my Facebook post too, that is so hard for me to have realized, but I'm so glad that I did. And it speaks to this point about how deep the cultural conditioning goes.
Yes.
And that is, you know, I wrote that when I drive through an African-American area of town, my cultural conditioning from childhood whispers in my ears, lock the doors. And you know, I know that I don't need to do that, but I just pay attention to those echoes, because as advanced, as progressed as I like to think that I am, I'm glad that I can see that, because it really does help me have compassion for those people who are fighting for those old ways. And I just know that they were conditioned to believe those things too.
Yeah.
You know, and when you grow up with that, you have to really understand that it's something to work for, to overcome.
Yes.
And you have to be willing to do that work, to overcome it. And I certainly am. And I think that one of the greatest signs and lights in our world right now is the fact that so many people are coming to this same place. I mean, even Jimmy Fallon, you know, one night a few weeks ago, after everything started happening with George Floyd, you know, he said, "I am guilty of just not understanding, not knowing. I'm starting a serious conversation now.
Yeah.
I have to learn how to be different." And it was so deep and so sincere. And I thought, this is a reflection of our collective consciousness right now.
I think it is. It really is. I mean, when you see the books that are sold out,
And
you know, and they're all about, you know, learning about white fragility and learning about, you know, Jim Crow and all of these different, you know, mind shaping. But let's see, there was something else I wanted to say. Oh, darn it. Is it okay if I share your post in the show's notes?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, wonderful. There was one other thing. I just, on what you said about that sort of, that unconscious fear that kind of we respond to, lock the doors and all of that.
Yeah.
And I just so much appreciate and love you and respect you for noting that and deciding, okay, I'm not going to be you know, giving that all of my attention or my respect even. And a couple of years ago, a friend of mine was teaching in a completely Black neighborhood in Oakland, which is typically Black anyway, population. And this was in a real at-risk school. And I was helping her in her classroom. And right down the corner was a little tiny neighborhood store. And I was hungry. And I just wanted to go in there. And it was dark and it was scary and it was crowded. And I was definitely going to be the only white woman in there. And I just didn't want to be afraid, you know? And I just went in there and people were just treated me like anybody else. And they were sweet and kind, but just, it was natural and real. And I got my snacks and no big deal, you know? And, you know, fear is one of the most, it's something obviously that the electorate in this country is manipulated with. And it is an emotion and a response that we have to be very careful about surrendering to, you know?
Yes.
I mean, there are times to be, you know, have some fear and have some caution for sure, but not all the time. Yeah.
Right. And, right. Oh, that's a wonderful story.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciated that you sat at the table when no one else did. And yeah, so that gave me, you know, reminded me and made me think, okay, this is an important story to share, just like yours was. So thank you.
Oh, great. Thank you, Nini.
Oh, okay, Jennifer. Thank you again.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Although it's a fact of life that we cannot change how others think if they're not open to another way of thinking, there are effective ways to start and engage in conversations with people who have even a small degree of openness to other perspectives. Braver Angels, the organization I mentioned in this conversation with Jennifer, is doing highly effective work at uniting Americans in efforts to depolarize our country by engaging those who disagree and guiding them to discover common ground and ways to work together. The Braver Angels online training is free, or maybe it's just very low cost. Yep, I want you to know it is highly effective and it's deeply gratifying training. You can learn more with videos on their site at braverangels.org. to see just how effective the organization is at educating people like you and me to better navigate challenging but important topics. Check it out, especially if you need a shot of real hope in these painful times. All right, thank you for sharing this journey of awakening, even if, like me, you're a late bloomer. We're here now, and there's so much to learn, so much to notice, so much to no longer let slip by. And it'll be so much easier together. So please share your questions, your comments, and your insights. They will add to the value of this podcast for everyone, especially all us white women and white men too. Thank you.